Thanks very much, Jan. I bring a handful of things with me. Don't panic. I'm not going to read all of everything. But I wanted to read a small anthology of Latin American literature, things that I've translated. As a translator, I write through other people's writing, and I speak through other people's voices. So it is my hope that you will hear four Latin American voices tonight. Four voices, three countries, two different centuries. I want to begin with the work of Luisa Valenzuela. Luisa Valenzuela is an Argentine woman living in New York, sometimes in Mexico. The political situation has eased enough. She's now able to return to Argentina, but she doesn't live there. She is a marvelous-looking woman with bright black eyes and marvelous curling hair, which I hope you will hear in one of the poems that I'm going to read, that you will hear Luisa in that poem. It's called Playing with Boys. Ways I learned as a little girl. That darling child, the one with the tight ringlets and serious eyes there in the park, hands behind her back, that's me. I stand watching at a careful distance, eyes narrowed, hands clenched behind my back, watching the bench where I have spread out my toys. Bait of little trains, a variety of cars, and all the boys in the plaza before my bench, reaching out tentative hands. They're mine, I will say when finally they touch them, and the invitation will fall like an ultimatum. You want to play with me? She has Luisa is known as a short story writer and novelist. Her latest novel is just out with Fairstrauss and Giroux. You will have been seeing the reviews. The Lizard's Tale, translated by Greg Rabassa. These prose poems were the first poems that Luisa had ever done. It's very fun to work on them with her. Then we're going to be also working on some short pieces, too. This is an untitled prose poem. They say that once widowed, my grandmother learned to wield the whip over her seven sons. It would seem that the whip is in my blood. I would like to tame wild beasts, but fate seldom sends me animals that must be broken. Only an occasional cub, or from time to time, some puffed-up creature of little substance. That is why at certain times I lay about me wildly with the whip. I thrash the air with blind fury, but often the whip curls back on me, and unwittingly I scourge myself. Pure carelessness. One of the fun things about translating, and one of the maddening things about translating, is question of puns, what to do with puns. And these two poems are called Latin Americanisms because they're based on expressions in certain countries that don't mean something else in other countries and certainly don't mean it in English. So that the poem is based upon a pun which in Argentina, the word is bichos. In all of Latin America, it means little animals. In Argentina, it means seafood, and in Chile, it has a very strong sexual connotation. Latin Americanisms 1. The Republic of Uruguay, the beach at Punta del Este. At the ripe age of 3, I push open the hotel swinging door, joining and separating dining room and kitchen, and command, "I want those cock things," referring to the delights, not exclusive, of the edible clam. Prophetic words, mine. A bit farther west, in Chile, farther up, and farther down, especially farther down, I continued to demand cockles, but with no desire for clams. And so it has gone with me. And so I have had the fortune to travel the continent by routes not always oral, at times pleasureful. Latin Americanisms, too. Is it because of that early memory I tend to say, the flesh is weak, or man is but flesh, but, like any good Argentine, add not to waste a moment's time, so bring on the meat. Luisa, prose style in these little pieces that she's been doing, I think you will hear, borders very closely upon the prose poems that it's difficult sometimes to hear the line between her prose and her poetry. This is called A Dream About Mercedes. I would like to tell you very briefly that when Bill and I were last year in Argentina at the Grace of Arts America, we visited five countries in Latin America, and we were in Buenos Aires being taken to lunch with a prominent woman writer named Luisa Mercedes Levinson. And as we approached, the woman who was escorting us said, you know, her daughter writes. And I didn't even have to ask. I knew. It was Luisa Valenzuela. It was marvelous, an exciting thing to have that happen. This is titled A Dream About Mercedes, because Mercedes is also a town in Argentina. A dream about Mercedes. It was an error, horror, not to say a dream in Mercedes, to avoid the misunderstanding that can arise when a city has a woman's name. What a place. The parting of the waters, the perfect spot to sit and wait if you don't know which slope you want to flow down. And it is at this point of the reading where one falls into one's own trap, as we will see, because the author was referring, or thought she was referring, or rather was attempting to refer to herself in a strictly geographical sense. So then, this most serious subject, transsexuality, will be analyzed as we go along. As it often happens, as it should happen, when one is able to plunge into the depths and send up to the surface to sway and bob all the fauna and flora and enigmas, stigmas, the monstrous magmas and miasmas that pullulate in depths we don't even suspect exist. So the monsters thus formed become an indissoluble part of our beings, indissoluble in every meaning of the word, even meanings the word doesn't have but are added in our own connotations, because that's what happens with words, impregnable fortresses that both fortunately and unfortunately we manage to expunge, impugn, strip, and adorn until at times they are so exact that they become repulsive. Indissoluble, then, because we cannot separate them from our being, as well as because they are insoluble. They are never completely incorporated into our being, nor are they resolved. Not resolved, either in the sense of finding a solution or of acting with decision. Up to this point, definitely, up to this point, in what is referred to as the waking sector, as it is more alien, the dream sector turns out to be less contaminated and therefore more dangerous. So then, this is the dream, which I shall condense, a dream that refers back to itself and speaks in a clear voice of flowing down unknown slopes. The glass mannequin, the doll with a white lead-painted face, beautiful, poisonous, with hair black as coal, walks into a shop after speaking with me, and I stand looking at her through the glass panes of the door. Suddenly, the doll turns and retraces her steps, and I realize that I love her. When she is close enough, I reach out to stroke her face with tenderness, and beneath the thick white makeup, I feel the pricks of an incipient beard. Meaning, perhaps, that in Mercedes, finally, the two currents flow happily together. Thank you. That's Luisa Valenzuela. Now, if we may take a quantum leap back to the 17th century, I would like to read just briefly from the work of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. I am obsessed with Sor Juana. I have been obsessed with Sor Juana for the last 2 years. She is the most remarkable woman in this hemisphere, and unfortunately, no one knows who she is. Very few people. I was extremely tempted to read to you from this book called A Woman of Genius, which is the Respuesta a Sor Filoteo de la Cruz in Spanish, is her intellectual autobiography, is the first document in this hemisphere on a woman's right to study and teach and read. But I saw what was going to happen if I began reading from it was that we were going to have an evening with Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And that wasn't what I wanted to do. I can't resist reading this one-liner to you. If you think one-liners didn't exist in the 17th century, you're mistaken. She is berating under a pseudonym and under a very controlled way. She's berating her confessor who forced her to renounce her writing and her studying. And this is only one line in a remarkable document, complaining about her not being allowed to teach young women when she thinks that's entirely suitable. And I would add that a fool may reach perfection, if ignorance may tolerate perfection, by having, I blew the whole thing. Let me start one line back. Latin is, a wise man has said, he who does not know Latin is not a complete fool, but he who knows it is well qualified to be. And I would add that a fool may reach perfection, if ignorance may tolerate perfection, by having studied his tittle of philosophy and theology, and by having some learning of tongues, by which he may be a fool in many sciences and languages. A great fool cannot be contained solely in his mother tongue. I was trying to decide what to read because the scope of her poetry is so enormous that I simply became befuddled, and I want to read two little tiny things that delight me, one sonnet and an epigram, and these go very quickly indeed. These are very frothy things. Do not think that this is entirely typical of her work, because she wrote very serious epistemological poetry and philosophical poetry, and has a great deal more weight than you would derive from what I'm reading tonight. The title of this Décima is a 10-line poem broken down into 2 5-line rhymed stanzas with 4 rhymes. She assures that she will hold a secret in confidence. The page, discreetly, will relate how, the moment it was read, I tore your secret into shreds, that shreds be not the secret's fate. And something more, inviolate, I swallowed what you had confessed, the tiny fragments of your note, to guard the secret that you wrote, and honor thus your confidence, lest even one scrap escape my breast. The second décima, Sor Juana was a painter. From what we can read, what we can deduce from the little that survives of her writing, and we believe that there is a self-portrait of Sor Juana, maybe the portrait that's in Philadelphia Museum. But here we have evidence that she did paint, because she sent a miniature to her patroness, accompanying a ring bearing the portrait of La Señora Condesa de Paredes. She explains, "This portrait, traced by arrogance, was nonetheless by love inspired, whereon a clumsy hand conspired to give emotion utterance. No bursting breast can countenance for long the presence of perfection, but needs must spill out its affection. Then let your index finger show the miniature, that all may know the ring indexes my subjection. Juana lived in the convent, but she continued to participate in the court life, and people came to her and said, Juana, write me a love poem. Juana, write me a poem for a birthday. Juana, write me this, write me that. So this is one of the love sonnets that she may have written for someone else, that she may have written for herself. We will probably never know. She answers suspicions in the rhetoric of tears. My love, this evening when I spoke with you, as in your face and actions, I could read that arguments of words you would not heed. My heart I longed to open to your view. In this intention, love my wishes knew, and though they seemed impossible, achieved. Pouring in tears that sorrow had conceived, with every beat, my heart dissolved anew. Enough of suffering, my love, enough. Let jealousy's vile tyranny be banned. Let no suspicious thought your calm corrupt with foolish gloom by futile doubt enhanced. For now, this afternoon, you saw and touched my heart dissolved and liquid in your hands. And again, so you would not be misled, I want to read you one epigraph from an illustrious journal called the River Styx, which is called Satiric Reproach to a Woman Who Boasts of Her Beauty, another facet of Sor Juana. Dear Leonor, they've given you the palm for beauty, or so you say. But have no fear for your virtue. That face would save you any day. You sing your praises without qualm. To hear you tell it, men lose their wits. But if they've given you the palm, it's from the date, for you're the pit. A rather remarkable woman. Now we'd like to leap back to this century and to a different sex and to the noble voice, indeed the Nobel voice, of Pablo Neruda. It's the Odas Elementales that I have translated, the odes that I think are quite central to his work. In many ways, they're central in time. They're central to his work because he invented a form for the odes. Following the odes, there is a new Neruda. There's always a new Neruda. Someone said he's like an onion. He keeps shedding his skin, and then there's another Neruda. He constantly evolved, as good artists do. Before the time, the approximate time of the odes, there are three books of the odes. Again, I could have had an evening with Pablo Neruda. He was a very hermetic, very nihilistic, very closed, very difficult, often surrealistic poet. Something happened to him. Many people think that, you know, if you know the great poem, The Heights of Machu Picchu, that it was that experience. He became a committed poet. He became a poet who wanted to communicate clearly. The odes are evidence of that desire to communicate. They are of a deceptive simplicity. Some of them absolutely marvelous. I love the form of them. If you know the odes, on the page they're like this, and some of them get very thin indeed. I hope you will hear that they get as thin as two letters in some lines. Again, we had the opportunity on that marvelous trip to visit Isla Negra, that marvelous home that Neruda had built as his life and career evolved and as his collections evolved, one of which is a collection of ships in bottles. And there is a long, rather rough corridor, half of which is glass, and against that glass, hundreds and hundreds of ships in bottles. And now when I think of this ode, I like to think of Neruda sitting at his desk looking at a ship and a bottle, and I feel this marvelous sense of communication. So this is ode to a ship and a bottle. No one ever sailed as your ship sails. Transparent day never saw a vessel like that tiny petal of glass imprisoned in your clasp of dew, bottle. Your winds fill its sails, bottle. Yes, substance of sea voyage, essence of trajectory, capsule of love upon the waves, work of sirens. I know that through your delicate throat passed we carpenters on the backs of bees, that flies hauled in tools, nails, boards, the finest strands of rope, and thus, within a bottle, the perfect ship took form. The hull was the kernel of its beauty. The masts rose thin as pins. Then, to their infinitesimal islands, the shipbuilders returned. And to sail the ship inside the bottle came, singing, a miniature crew in blue. And so, bottle, within your sea and sky was raised a ship, tiny, no, minuscule, compared to the enormous waiting sea. But the truth is, no one built it, and only in dreams will it sail. I have a rather, thank you, a brief ode, very brief, and a longer ode, which I hope won't be too long, both of which I chose because of that experience of having been to Isla Negra and having walked on the beach where Neruda looked as he was writing the odes. It's amazing what that feeling can do for you, to be there and re-enter that moment in your imagination. One of which is called Ode to a Few Yellow Flowers. Please remember in this ode that the seasons are reversed and we're coming to spring in Chile. Ode to a Few Yellow Flowers. Against the blue, waving its blues, the sea, and against the sky, a few yellow flowers. October's on the way. And although the sea is so important, cultivating its myth, its mission, its leaven, on the sand explodes the gold of a single yellow plant, and your eyes are bound to the earth, fleeing the surge of the mightiest sea. Dust we are, shall be, not air, not fire, not water, but earth. Only earth we shall be, and maybe a few yellow flowers. These are sort of brief. You don't need to do that. This one, where is the sea, where the shore met the sea, meant life. This ode refers to death, the death of the Voyager albatross, and in all the symbology that's much too obvious to even mention, and I apologize for it, the sea and the shore are both those things. Ode to the Voyager albatross. A great gray albatross died the other day. Here's where it fell upon the wet sands. In this gloomy month, on a silvery, drizzly autumn day, like a web of cold fish and seawater. This is where it fell, the Magna Avis. It was in death a cross of black. The wings spanned 3 feathered meters. The head curved like a hook. The cyclonic eyes were tightly sealed. From New Zealand, it had crossed an ocean to die in Chile. Why? Why? What salt, what wave, what wind could it have sought in the sea? Why pit its strength against all space? Why test its powers in the harshest solitudes? Or was its goal the magnet of a star? No one will ever know or tell. No island breaks this broad expanse of ocean, and the albatross, tracing a parabola in victorious flight between planets, encountered only days, nights, water, solitude, and space. In flight, the bird was energy, direction, eyes conquering sun and shadow as it slipped through the skies toward the farthest unknown land. Far-ranging bird, aloft, you seemed suspended between continents over lost seas. A flick of a wing, a whir of feathers. Majestically, you changed your course a fraction and, triumphant and true, continued on your implacable, lonely route. How beautiful you were, wheeling slowly between wave and air, trailing the tip of a wing in the sea.